Blog Talk Radio.
If I speak for your followers, and I speak for your ex-followers, and I speak for the curious outsiders looking in, and you remain silent in the shadows and don't let your balls drop enough to come out and say something, then I say, who do you speak for, Mr. Miscavige?
Anything on earth that says, don't listen to your mum and dad, don't talk to your mum and dad, that's bad.
Yep. Wrong.
I remember sitting there wishing I could just scream out loud and beg for help. But I knew if I did that, I would never see Mark again.
This is the thing about real life. You can't experience the great things without the bad things.
I felt like it would probably be better off if we didn't exist. And, came up with a plan on how to end it.
He talks about a seven-year-old child.
Mm-hmm.
Even if he's referring to actually an adult, so let's say we change that to an adult. Okay, the woman shudders because the man hits her even passionately. The fact is that he shudders.
You do a big apology to me and give me my kids back.
I'm still shocked by the evil. Yes, even to this day, when I see a video of a former friend or family member, I'm like, this is pure evil at work.
Hello, welcome to another Come and Get Some Extra Scientology Edition today with Marcus Sawyer. And I know it's been a really good while since we've done one of these Scientology podcasts to Come and Get Some Extra. During my time off, I've been working and struggling and researching ways to better the audio quality of this podcast. Never more clear to me than listening back to that opening just now, how challenging that's been. But I believe I've got it figured out today with Marcus. Might be one of the clearest sounding interviews I've put out. So hopefully I've got the quality up where it needs to be that both the guest and the listener you all deserve. So there's that, but a lot's happened since I last talked to you guys, so let's get into it. First of all, let's go ahead and congratulate Mike Rinder, Leah Remini, the whole A&E crew for The Inevitable, for making Season 3 a reality. Scientology and the Aftermath is coming back, so congratulations on that. Also, a few folks got together and created what's called the Aftermath Foundation. This can be found on the aftermathfoundation.org. The link is in the description of this podcast. It's founded by Luis Garcia, Aaron Smith-Levin, Claire Headley, Christy Colburn, Mike Rinder, Mark Headley, and Ray Jeffrey. All came together to create this foundation as a way to help people who are on the fence, people with nowhere to turn, looking for a way out, to have some place to turn. For more details on what exactly is expected and exactly the function of the Aftermath Foundation, there is a video on YouTube on Aaron Smith-Levin's YouTube channel, Growing Up in Scientology, explaining the Aftermath Foundation in pretty good detail. So check that out. I may be adding that link a little bit later here to this podcast. So there's that, and that's a great thing, and it's got a bunch of links up here. One, you can request help if you're one of those folks looking for a way out. You can donate to the foundation 100%, I believe, going right into that fund. And you can volunteer, and you can contact them if you have any questions on the contact us link. So a little mapping of the website there. What else happened? Let's see. I went to the downtown Clearwater, also an event to promote the Aftermath Foundation and the downtown Clearwater District Business District, trying to grow it and make it better. So I actually have a video up on my YouTube channel. It's the Come Get Some Extra YouTube channel. It's a 360 video. You can see 360 clips of the event and host Clay Irwin's Lucky Anchor Bar and Grill there. So you can see, well, Lucky Anchor Irish Pub, sorry. Over there, so you can see what that was like. So you get a little piece of that. And so on that YouTube channel, I do have the Leah Remini interview. I don't know if I'm going to be transferring all the old interviews over because of the audio quality, but I'm just going to go from here and just start putting the real ones over. The event was amazing, by the way, from top to bottom, from Mike Rinder to Tara Riley and all points in between. Just a wonderful bunch of people, including the residents, the Never-Ends who came to support. It was just a great event overall, and I recommend going to the next one if you have a chance. Great to see everybody there. The Scientology TV network has begun, so Comedy Central is in for a little bit of competition. I watched a little bit of this, and it speaks for itself. I know there will be, and Marcus talks about this, I think, in part two on Friday, about how he believes that there'll still be people who fall for Scientology through the networks. So it's not a great thing still. But, wow, what a – I'd say it's a disaster, but time will tell, and we'll see. The other thing, the main thing I wanted to talk about before we get into the interview is our Twitter friends, quote-unquote friends, John Hawkswood and Gemma Harris, they've been at it again. I'm going to say this. I found value in their existence just in the way that anyone who's known me for any length of time or known of the show knows that it was John Hawkswood and Gemma Harris's tweets that showed me exactly who they are and what Scientology is, so that I could see that this wasn't exaggeration. To see that was an eye-opener that allowed me to feel comfortable doing this podcast. There is value there. However, it's important to remember who these guys are. They seem like bumbling idiots, and they kind of are, and they're ridiculous, and don't have much to offer in any way, shape, or form productive. But remember, they are also, at the very least, John Hawkswood is. And this isn't a thing where Leah says it, or Mike says it, or Chris Shelton says it, or I say it. It's our best guess. John Hawkswood's been known to be also for decades. He was very involved in the counter special to Scientology and Me to try to make John Sweeney look like a fool, which kind of backfired on Scientology. So they exist to spread hate, discontent, confusion, distraction. They want to hurt people because they feel that people are trying to hurt them. And in a way, you know, there's some people I think out there who think they're going to reach Gemma Harris and save her or turn John Hawkswood around. At this point, I feel like they know enough to know, and they have to be complicit in some way and know what you're doing. That's my opinion. Any interaction, I don't care if you're making them look bad, any interaction, you're giving them stats. You're helping them. There's nobody who's been hurt by Scientology or hurt by them in the smear campaigns going, wow, I'm so glad you're on my side because you really hurt Gemma on that Zedu comment. So I don't know why you would interact with them other than to help them, you know, and I'm not going to judge anyone and say, you know, I don't think anyone's going to listen to me and just go, okay, well, Chris says it and Shelton says it and Ortega says it, so we're just going to leave them alone. But you're really only helping them. They're not reaching anybody, but you're bringing more attention to them, more stats to them. Why would you want to help? And as a result of that, there was a faceless, nameless Twitter account that a bunch of people in the Twitter community were attached to. She was supportive of the X community, and she was fighting the fight. But she was having fun with her account, and not everything she was saying was truthful. And out of all the hundreds and thousands of people who go at Gemma Harris daily, weekly, monthly, they decided to take her and make an example out of her. She didn't have her real name or information out there, but they tracked her down, and they made a hate page on faceless, nameless Twitter person to expose them, and in the process, expose their entire family as people to be associated with as enemies and bigots. And it's really disgusting because, you know, forget the lies. And I don't say that lightly because I never will support the idea of lying to get the best of someone who's already bad anyway, but I'm not going to apologize to them either. And I'm not going to apologize for it. So it was wrong and bad to tell stories and make up stories, and I don't know how much was true or not, but I know there was some liberties taken with honesty there. And I can't condone that. But faceless, nameless lady on Twitter doesn't have a lot of responsibility in this. I mean, there's moral, ethical, whatever. You know, you can hold it against this person personally if you wish. That's your determination, but that's your prerogative. But these two people are supposed to represent the most ethical religion on earth. And they attack faceless, nameless person. And it makes me laugh, kind of, that all these years, longer than I've been around with social media or doing this podcast, there are people today who are going round and around with Gemma. They've been going round and round with her 4 years ago, her and John. If this is the best they can do, again, pretty bumbling, pretty idiotic, pretty silly, but at the end of the day, why even bother? And that's all that needs to be said about it, I feel. Why would you want to help them? That's all. At any rate, here is my conversation with Marcus Soder. All right, today on the show, I'm going to talk to an ex-Scientologist that I met at the downtown Clearwater event just recently, and he just recently did an interview with Aaron Smith Levin. Marcus Soder, thank you for coming on the show, Marcus.
Yeah, you're welcome. Where's the applause? You need the canned applause.
I don't have my sound drops.
Yay!
I can edit it in.
I did it for you. How's it going, man?
Yes,
we got it. We got the podcast going now.
Yes, you have the distinct honor of being bestowed upon you to be the first perfectly clear podcast that I ever do.
You know, I have a face for radio. I used to work in radio.
I'm putting a lot of faith in myself here on this one. And yes, you have a face for radio. But you do your YouTube series.
Yeah, sure did. My face is all over that.
Right, and so you like to, if I'm not mistaken, you like to really take the subject of Scientology and dissect it in your videos and really talk from a philosophical standpoint.
Well, I've got, I think, around 167 videos now, which is just unreal to me because a lot of them are really long. So I even wonder what I'm talking about in some of these videos, and maybe I should trim the fat. But most of the time, it was a progression, really, from the first video and then feeling more comfortable talking about stuff. And when I started to, like, look at some of the it took a year for me to go through all the material online and read all the stories, because you take it in, at least I did, I took it in slowly because I didn't want to read it all at once and go be in shock, and that can have me, I felt like that would happen. I was afraid that OT3 was going to give me pneumonia, so I took all that in very slowly, and then I find in 2014 when I started the blog, Man of the Year blog, I was feeling rather ambitious, and started writing a few blog posts, and started thinking about making a video about my experience in Scientology, because I've been COMEV, which is Scientology's kind of like a court situation. I it's like a Nazi tribunal. You go and there's three people, usually executives, that accuse and hurl accusations at you, and you just sit there and take it and you grovel, and then if you grovel enough, then you get to be back in the good graces of the church, but you end up in a shittier ethics condition. I'm sorry if that's not good for radio. Is this a clean talk show?
Oh,
are we running a clean show here?
Ah, what the hell.
Okay.
Say whatever the fuck.
Well, I'm not going to cuss just to cuss, but you know, anyways, the amount of shit they throw at you, you know, it's just another way to break you down, in other words, and keep you in, and keep you exclusive to their needs, and not your own. So I didn't go to the COMEV, and I started to think about making the video, and I did a couple of little write-ups. And milestone one I did not long after I published the first YouTube video. And I know this is a long question, a long answer, but like I said, 167 videos And what I do is I compare, I take concepts from psychology and sort of try to make sense out of them in term with the Scientology. Because in Scientology, I always found that there were little snippets like bait of truth taken from somewhere else, stolen from some other great thinker. And then that was the bait for the mind to take. Then it replaces it with the fixed idea that Hubbard wants you to believe. So basically the process of unbrainwashing, like that's how I feel like it was for me. Like, and I did it online because for me, seeing other people talk about their experiences, the videos that I watched the year prior, was instrumental in me doing it for myself. And so I have those people to thank that came before and did stuff like, you know, even it might be controversial to say, but Jerry Armstrong, I watched all of his videos that he did in the 80s, and Mike Rinder was huge. You know, I didn't even know that he left until 2012.
Oh, wow.
Because I was still, yeah, I mean, he left in 08, but I didn't know because I was just keeping my head down and not sure whether I was going to go back to Scientology. So, yeah, when I found out Mike left, I think it was Travis that sent me a mail and said, did you know that Mike Rinder left? And I was like, fuck no. And I went and looked at the website. And the way that he did it at the time that he did it was perfect for me because it still had a little gleam of Scientology. The title of his blog is Something Can Be Done About It. And that's taken from The Way to Happiness.
It catches your
eye. And Scientology shit. Yeah. And yeah, and it was like, okay, I can trust him. He's not in Scientology anymore. He was like the director of special affairs, which God bless his soul. Yeah. Oh God, I can't even imagine how you know what he had to do. But anyways, yeah. So it's progressed into sort of like a very therapeutic method for me to express that whole experience, and hopefully people who have been involved or were thinking about getting involved can take that experience, and it's there for someone to view. It's not like super awesome content because, like I said, it's, you know, first video is 2 hours sitting there listening to a guy, blah 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 blah. This is what happened to me. This is what happened. Blah, 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 blah. It's not the most cheerful content in the world.
Right.
But it's there. It's not there for mass consumption of that nature. You know, it's there for the people who have been completely destroyed and for them to know that they're not the only ones that have gone through it.
Right. That's good. So this is interesting. I want to explore this just a little bit here. So you just described, what was it, 2013, 2014, you were in an interesting place where you were questioning Scientology and also considering, oh, why the hell not go back? And you had to make that call there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I actually applied Scientology to decide whether or not I was going to stay in Scientology or leave Scientology. And I applied that formula, the doubt formula, 3 times from 2012 to 2014. And then in 2014, I finally finished my doubt condition. And what I did is I just ripped it up and I said, this is bullshit.
So
this is utter bullshit.
By actively applying the doubt, what was it called? The doubt condition.
The doubt condition, yeah.
You discovered that it was garbage through the process.
Yes.
This is not working.
Yes. Not even the doubt condition. I mean, you know, the thing about talking about some of the concepts of Scientology, a lot of people are very intrigued by, you know, all the terminology in Scientology because there is a lot of it. And there's a lot of it in every religion. And, you know, like my uncle is Catholic and some of the stuff he talks about, like the Crusades and the blah, 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 I'm like, well, I don't know what the heck you're talking about. But Scientology has a very large glossary of terms. I mean, it's as big as the Merriam-Webster's was in the 1800s, probably, you know, like the standard edition, not like the fancy, like only rich people can buy dictionaries, but like the common man's dictionary. Like it's about that big, maybe a little bigger. And, you know, there are tons of acronyms and terms, and they all mean very specific things that make sense if you make sense of them, if that makes sense.
Right. So you're basically convincing yourself it makes sense. So
yeah,
it almost makes the concept of whatever's true for you is true get you to convince yourself that, oh, no, I get it, because this is what it means. I've decided this is what it means.
Correct. And so, well, okay, then immediately you run into a problem there, because whenever you apply personal integrity, which is what you know to be true is true for you, you know, and that is true. When you say, well, pain and sex is not true. Pain and sex is an infamous reference in a technical bulletin that Hubbard wrote about failing pre-clears, like pre-clears that were stalled on the bridge. And so he ordered that basically these technical bulletins were sent out to the Hubbard auditing, HSA, Association of Scientologists, Hubbard Association of Scientologists International. And they would distribute these bulletins. And so, you know, anyways, pain and sex is one of these whole track discoveries that he made, where he found out that the whole reason for misery and all this shit in the entire universe for 76 trillion years is pain and sex, and that thetans get stuck to them. And so you have to audit pain and sex, you know, like,
really?
And
why there's so many sexual references in that I've heard about through auditing and sex checks.
Dude, I mean, you can draw the line there, can't you? I mean, pain and sex is an article. If you're on staff, it's a bulletin that you will be exposed to. Because if you try to have a 2D, which is a girlfriend or a boyfriend, whatever case, the missions that I worked at, okay? You know, I've talked to other people who worked at missions, and they're like, our mission was not like that. But I've talked to people in the Sea Org, and I have more in common with them than I do with the people who worked at, like, the Los Feliz mission or the Van Nuys mission or wherever. Even the Baton Rouge mission was run differently, but it was still the Steiners, and it's the South. So, I don't know. There was different implications to running staff and having them out on the streets than there are in L.A., whereas we could be out on the street all day long like Mormons banging books, you know?
Right.
So I kind of got off track there, but the I think the point is that what's true for you is true for you, and whenever you don't agree with it, like pain and sex, because it's just even some of the executives would wouldn't discredit the reference. Because they're the executives, they're not going to do that. They're going to basically bow to LRH. But you could tell that they're like, they don't, or they would sometimes say, well, you know, I don't really get it either, but that's what LRH says. So it must be true.
Sort of
which is astonishing.
Just to get through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, it goes into a lot of description of what happens to a being. And when you start thinking of yourself, it's such an internalizing process, every bit of it, you know. And if you're, it really is sad, because a lot of people who are very caring, like empathetic people, people who want to help others, are really, really like diametrically, magnetically opposed, or they attract, because you give someone who has all this empathy a chance to, quote, help everybody and heal the world, you know, they're gonna go for it, even at their own sacrifices that they make, because they think it's for the greater good.
Right. So could you give me, just because you mentioned it earlier, I'm just curious now, what is the doubt condition? How does that operate? What is the functionality of it?
All right. So most of my books are gone, but I remember most of the conditions well enough anyway. The doubt condition, and if there's any listeners that are on a computer, just Google the Scientology doubt condition. You'll be able to find it probably on their website. Except it's going to be a little different. So I would maybe look for the Wikipedia version. Basically what it is deciding who to side with. You know, it's like it puts you in a tug of war, and you have to list out reasons to stay or reasons to go.
Okay.
And that in itself, for a personal inventory, is not a bad thing to do. You could go to a psychologist and they might tell you, make a list of things that you want in your life and make a list of things that you don't want in your life.
Absolutely.
All right. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're on staff, where I was on staff, and pretty much any staff, I would argue, you not only have that to contend with, it's rigged against you, because the group is meant to work as a single unit. And so when one particle, and it's a term they literally call people, when one particle starts to stray off, then the other particles hurtle around it and bring it back to the center. And when I say that, I'm using just sort of a metaphor as to, if someone's having a personal problem or a family crisis and they can't donate for some reason, or they can't make it to volunteer to do central file sorting, then they can be assigned a condition, a lower condition, which, you know, could be doubt. And they'll be asked, right, point blank, us or them. And the whole staff is in on it, and even some of the public is, you know. If someone, it's well known, it's rumors that happen on staff as well, that even if there's no word spoken, when someone's in a lower condition, their general demeanor is sad on the tone scale. All right, so if you use the tone scale, Hubbard's little tone scale, and you look at someone who's in a lower condition, they'll be low on the tone scale.
Right.
So what does everyone else around them do? They go slightly above the tone of the person who's low toned and try to make them feel better. Because the Hubbard's rule from Science of Survival is that when someone is low on the tone scale, you go one half a point to a point above it, and then you will raise him up to that level. Then once you get to that point, you do it again and again until you get the desired state of emotional awareness. And everybody who did the SOS course at Buenaventura knew all that. That was a big, big push, was do the Science of Survival and the PTSSP course. So a lot of the public there did those courses, and they were also instrumental in helping keep staff on staff, telling staff, you know, you're doing an amazing thing. You're saving the planet. I wish I could be like you. You're a hero telling you this shit. You know, you're living in a damn shit box half a mile down the road with eight people, birds screaming and sleeping, you know, with no, there's like a porch in the back with no windows on it, people sleeping out there.
Right.
I slept on the balcony on insulation when we were building the Melrose mission, you know, for 6 months.
Okay.
So... But you're a hero.
So it's love bombing, really, to get you out of that lower condition.
Right.
It seems to me, if I'm not mistaken, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that there's a lot of people in Scientology who have convinced themselves, and they may not really be happy, but they convince themselves that their tone, what they call tone 40, right? Just like ultimate. You're
right.
You convince yourself you're tone 40, and it's actually extremely unhealthy in my mind because you're kind of living a lie within yourself.
I won't correct you. I will enlighten you. Tone 40 is essentially, in psychology, suppressing your own emotions. That's what tone 40 is. It's shut the hell up. Don't have any case on, and also no case on post, which is something that I don't hear a lot of people say. I hear everyone who was on staff mention it, but I don't think everyone, that's why I like Aaron's interviews, because he stops to define the terms. Right. No case on post means you are not to think about yourself. You are not to worry about any of your own problems. You are not to have any manifestations or aberrations about your own case, which means you as a person, because we're not looking at you as a person. We're looking at you as a spiritual being capable of literally anything. You could turn into a chair, who knows? You can see air, you know, you can think a thought and someone calls you, you know. These are all these OT potentialities that they talk about in the Philadelphia doctorate lectures and the Phoenix lectures and the State of Man Congress, and you know, it's no case on post and tone 40 are thought stopping methods.
Right. And so that pretty much is basically exactly right. One thing you said that I'm trying to get back to this here. You talked about the people who inspired you, that came before you and spoke out. Do you feel, and I want to kind of tie this in sort of with your website and your blogs, do you feel like you have a responsibility to speak out, or is it just something that you do because...
Hell yeah, I did, because that's the whole reason I joined Scientology, because I felt responsible for the planet. I don't know why, I just feel, I'm a compassionate person, I love people. And I hate to see people suffer, man. I could talk about all kind of suffering that I've been through, you know. But it's really, you know, you can choose how you view your experience, and that is something that is life changing, you know. When you can choose how to view your experience and it doesn't have to hurt you anymore. Life-changing experience. And so with the... I'm sorry, I completely spaced out there. You asked me a question. What was it?
What was your responsibility to educate others and speak?
Okay, yeah, responsibility. Correct. All right, so... I felt responsible because there was one guy in particular that sparked it. And then after I sort of started processing that, which I did with another ex-Scientologist who was on staff with me and who was a part of that process with this person. There was a celebrity upcoming, he got signed to the Minnesota Twins, and we absolutely just raked him over the coals. And he was 18 years old, and he had all the things going for him. He was pitching at 102 right out of high school, and He got signed right out of high school. The summer after he graduated, he was in the minors and had contracts and endorsements and all kind of good stuff happening, investors. And his name was Alex Merricks. And that was the second video that I made on my YouTube channel, was Scientology ruining careers, because that's exactly what we did with Alex Merricks. And I felt horrible about it. And I spoke with some other people who were involved in the cycle, and you know, some of them didn't really give a shit, and some of them, it was like I had to sort of like pique their moral compass, you know, and be like, hey, like, this thing worked, because what we did was wrong, you know. There were some people who were still Scientologists that I was talking to prior to 2014 about all this, before I just, it took a long time, in other words, for me to make the, to start making content, making anything with a blog or a YouTube, because I needed to sort of talk to some of the other people to get, you don't ever get the full story when you're on staff, because the particle flow is controlled in such a way that it creates confusion. And that's part of people getting into Scientology and staying there, where you keep them in a state of confusion, and you can get money out of them if you spin them around. It's kind of like putting the tail on the donkey. I know it sounds a little weird, but, you know, imagine keeping particles, imagine people as particles, like in a experiment, like a little photon, like imagine a petri dish with a bunch of little photons, and they're particles, but they're people. Right. And they're just bouncing around, potential energy. All right. Scientology has, and they literally call it bodies in the shop. It's a statistic. The number of, and there's a reference in the management series that says the number of bodies in the shop is directly correlated to the amount of gross income. And so, and then there's other issues on particle control. So basically you get bodies in the shop, and then he'll tell you to dehumanize those bodies as particles, because then you don't care if you rip them off and ruin their life, because they're just a particle.
Right. So, but you're not thinking in those terms, though. Like, you're not consciously making that correlation. I mean, I think...
No, you really think they're particles. You really think it's energy. You really think it's energy. You know, it's positive. It's theta, you know, as the term means positive. Or as Pentecostals or other religious people would say, in the spirit. You know, I find it completely a farce that Scientologists like to compare themselves to Buddhists. I just wanted to throw that out there. I think that's just the most ridiculous fucking thing I've ever heard any religion say, in comparing themselves to any other religion ever.
Yeah, I almost think it's almost like a comparison of convenience.
You know, I don't know.
Because he does borrow a couple little things.
He borrows from everybody, everything. And that's the problem with it, is that, you know, anybody can... People still don't believe it. People still don't believe that anybody can get sucked in to Scientology. I'm here to tell you, it can happen.
Absolutely.
It can happen. It can still happen. In fact, whenever they launched the network, me and Travis watched a little bit of it, and we both had the same thought. We're like, they'll get some people off of this. They won't get a lot, but they'll get some. And I mean, they're going to get some, you know, they're going to get some. It's law of averages, you know, law of averages.
And when I say a week, I'm not saying people who fall for it a week. I just mean they're going through bad times. They're looking for answers. They'll find them.
Usually they are in a weak spot. But let me tell you something, Padna, like my buddy Adam used to say, he was the bookstore officer. I'd love to get you to interview him. He's a boat captain. He's a one-legged boat captain and crane operator. He's an amazing person. Cajun French. May he talk like that. Man, I'm going fishing. I got to talk about
that. I wonder how
Adam.
He's going to react to that impersonation.
we talk like that to each other.
Oh, do you?
I'll call him and be like, man, what you doing? Man, I'm gonna mange that. I'm hungry, me. I want some rice and gravy. I got some boudin over at the market basket. Whoo, y'all, that was some good boudin.
Okay.
And we'll just go on and on and on until we just like, okay, that's enough. Because that's how our families talked. Our mamas and papas mostly spoke French. So
okay.
We have that heritage in common. But he used to he was involved with the Alex Merrick cycle, and he's one of the guys I talked to who also feels a sense of responsibility to talk about things that have happened, because he actually he won an award at FLAG for the highest number of books sold.
Yay.
Yeah, he sold more Dianetics books for the Buenaventura mission than any of the other missions in the mission network internationally.
Wow, awesome hustling.
He is a hustler, not was. He still is. He's a hustler. So the responsibility. Yeah, I mean, I just felt like the people who had done it for me, maybe, because I'll be honest, like I didn't identify with everything they said, because it was a different organization in the 70s and the 60s and the 80s. You know, it changes. They rewrite the damn books.
Right.
And they change, they change strategies a lot, and the org board, people change jobs all the time. They call it change in posts so it's a destabilizing, confusing bouncy ball pinball organization. That's what if I had to describe it, what it feels like to be in it, it's like you're in a pinball machine and you're the pinball, and when you get out of it, it's like all you want is to like be stable. All you want to do is just sit still, you know. You don't know what the hell you want to do.
Right, it's like the pea under the coconut shells moving around trying to follow the pea.
Yeah, I mean, you're lost. You're just lost. And
is that a Hubbard strategy, or do you think that's a Miscavige strategy? Keep them moving around so they can't ever get comfortable in one place and figure things out?
I think that's more of a Miscavige strategy, but I think that he got it from Hubbard. I just think that Hubbard probably didn't employ it to the degree that that Miscavige did. But the question you ask, you could almost answer it yourself, because that's exactly how he usurped the power. Is he just started ping-ponging particles everywhere, and then at the end of the ping-pong party, he ended up with the ping-pong ball.
Right.
I do horrible analogies. I'm sorry.
It's quite all right. So,
I used to do that with people that I was working with on public lines. I never got people. I did do Division 6, where you go out and you recruit people, and you get them signed up for first service starts. But after we got them in, I didn't have much to do with them. I would I didn't teach them anything. I was there to mine their network and get other friends involved. So sometimes I would sit down and the more I knew about all the tech and all that shit, the more tools I had to brainwash people.
Right. I mean, it sounds like you almost kind of started to figure out what you were doing consciously, but you're still trying to figure out why it was okay.
Well, I mean, in my mind, it was okay because I knew that I was a spiritual being that was not going to die. And when I do die, I'd prefer to know that I died and be able to pick where I want to go after I'm dead and not be an unaware. See, the pitch that they give you is that if you die, instead of hell, you're just like unconscious as a being and you don't know what's going on. And you're also running into other unconscious beings who don't know what the hell's going on. And you're picking up their memories and their experiences from their past lives. And since they're so unaware, they can only hold on to the negative ones because their energy level is so low. So they're only holding on to negative experiences. And as a Thetan, if you're at that awareness level and you die, you drop your body, you're essentially, you'd be lucky to get another body. You're essentially going to have eternal hell living in your and everyone else's bad memories.
Right. You ever wonder why the aliens that were blown up in the volcano, their spirits, their Thetan, attaches to us, but when we die, we don't attach to other people?
Well, that's what I'm saying, man. Like, what I extrapolated from what I read and what I heard, which wasn't the Xenu stuff, I'm talking about the factors, which is a hard read if you're not a Scientologist. It's a hard read if you are a Scientologist. But it's the genesis story of Scientology, the factors. And basically, it describes three-dimensional space and how consciousness was created, all right? It's his own personal genesis. And it's very Einsteinian, and it's, you know, it appeals to that kind of sensibility, but there is no in fact basis of reality for it scientifically. But you can conceptualize it, and the way that I conceptualized it was in terms of energetic beings or energy that was what Hubbard called theta, and it is consciousness, and it is not conscious. It's nothing. It's zero. You know. And so if you die and your consciousness is like I was saying earlier, if it's not, if you hadn't, weren't aware that you were a being that had abilities, if you forgot that you had abilities, because that's what the factors talked about, forgetting, which is another really, just it's so bizarrely occultish, because while on one hand it's interesting because it starts out talking about three-dimensional space, and it does, and there are some very interesting aspects of describing space and matter and stuff like that, but then it's about forgetting what you knew, you know, like the first Thetans, you know, they got bored because they were creating everything in the universe, and they knew everything that they created and how it was going to end, and how they were gods essentially. And so the gods decided to forget that they knew they were gods so that they could experience their creation as new, like a child. So they forgot they were gods, but then they remembered that they forgot that they were gods, so they had to decide and make it so that they couldn't remember that they could remember. This is no shit. This is the factors, and this is History of Man, and this is a Dianetics 55, and a couple of other things. Like, it's scattered. The information is scattered throughout all of the shit. And by this point, like I said, they've rewritten it and put shit in other places, and who knows what's what anymore. But, and I think that's part of, I think part of why they do that is to discredit people who have read the material. So if they change it, they'll be like, no, that's not what the material says. It's not what it says at all. This is what it says.
It would,
that's something that I think Hubbard would have definitely thought of. He's a very meticulous.
He thought of a lot.
He was He was a maniacal, schizophrenic, madman genius. Madman, yeah. I mean, madman slash genius, you know? I mean, just because you're a genius doesn't mean you're a good guy.
Right. I don't know.
You know what I mean?
Genius, but creative.
Maybe. Well, let me put it to you this way. Here's why I would call him a genius, and people can hate me for saying it. I could shove LRH, up his own ass, because what he did was horribly evil. You know, but at a certain point, he started to believe in himself, and you know, you reap what you sow.
Right.
And he did. He did reap what he sowed. He died horribly. He died horribly. But, and he lived horribly. You know, he just died and lived horribly. And not only that, but affected so many other people in that way. But the Church of Scientology still exists today.
Somehow.
It didn't die with him. It didn't die with him, and it should have.
Well, that was the ambition of one David Miscavige.
You're absolutely correct. And Mr. David Miscavige, well, he is a total freaking nutbag, man.
You know, I ask people about this. I'll get your opinion real quick. You know, a lot of the old guard, a lot of the people who were in there in the 70s and 60s, unless we forget, and sometimes I think people do forget, this is Hubbard was a man that tried to frame a woman for domestic terrorism and try to drive her to suicide. But
yeah,
people say that Hubbard wasn't as active as Miscavige, actively abusive, actively...
No, he was just nuts.
Yeah, he wasn't actively enforcing the SP thing, the whole disconnection thing. But I feel like, and you can tell me what you think on this, of course, I don't think you knew Hubbard personally any better than I would.
No.
But he...
he was dead before I even knew what Scientology was.
It seems to me that because of the changing times, sure, Miscavige might be more maniacal and a little bit more crazy, but because of the changing times and the access to information as we have it now, that Hubbard would have had to have started doing the exact same thing Miscavige is doing and enforcing things a little bit more tightly, and that would be the whole reason why he even wrote the policies. That's what I think.
Well, that's one of those, what do you call the red herrings? I don't know if I'm using that term correctly.
Hypothetical.
No, I don't think that's what it means, a red herring.
Well, red herring doesn't mean hypothetical. No, red herring means a misdirection.
Yeah, because had there not been a red herring, then David Mayo would have inherited the RTC. And David Mayo left after Miscavige usurped the church and started the Advanced Ability Organization in Santa Barbara, California, and was very successful for a number of years until David Miscavige sued the bejesus out of them for not calling it Scientology. And also Alter Is, which is a big sin in Scientology, where he was basically taking the things that were useful and he went to Santa Barbara and started a little deal there to help people with their trauma or whatever. Therapy. It was a therapy, but it wasn't clinical therapy. It was experimental pseudoscientific therapy, or holistic, if you will.
Okay.
And it was, it was watered down shit, you know? I wasn't there for it, but Tom and Kathy, the mission holders that we worked for, they had missions since the 60s and were staffed since the 60s. I know they lived in Ojai. They have places all over the world. Tom won some award at one of those big events in Flag one time for opening so many missions. But funny side note on him, I was in his office one time in ethics trouble, and he just couldn't care less. He's like listening to music and enjoying all the money he's ripping off everybody. And the dude literally had a liver transplant every year I worked there, and which was 2 years, but and he had one 2 years prior to that too.
Wasn't he not supposed to do that?
What do you mean? Because
well,
he's an
liver
OT
transplant, wouldn't he? I've heard so many stories of people.
Well, the body thetans, I guess we're getting them. You know, the body thetans are all up in his liver.
But I've heard so many stories of people dying because they weren't allowed to get medical attention, and they had to, you know, do touch assist and things of that nature.
Well, a lot of times it's not that it's not allowed. It's not that it's not allowed. It's that the people don't get it. They don't do it. Like Tom's OT8. Tom's OT8. He knows he's got Hep C, and he knows he needs livers, so he just gets livers.
Okay.
And God knows how. I don't want to know how, honestly. Because I always heard of having to get on a list.
A waiting list, yeah.
You know?
It's like hard and it takes.
And it's hard because they prioritize those things. Well, I remember one time on staff, it was like, you know, he was getting sick and he got jaundice, and they had to take him in to the hospital. They're like, you need a liver. Okay. I want to say 2 months later, he was back with a new liver.
Let me ask you this. So he takes it upon himself to go ahead and have the medical procedures, have the liver transplants. Do other Scientologists look down on him for that? Do they think less of him?
He's an OT-8, man. It's like
kind of untouchable a little bit?
Yeah, there's that vibe. It's like, you know, yeah, I'm OT-8. You don't know what I'm going through kind of thing, you know? Like, I'm dealing with OTH shit. That's God-level stuff. I mean, that's God.
He should be able to fix his liver with his mind, right?
Well, but the thing is, Hubbard talks about the wall of fire in the OT levels, or OT3. And he says, once you pass through the wall of fire, you know, there's no guarantee you're going to, you know, be all right. You got to audit correctly, you know? And so people... I'll put it to you this way, as far as how it's perceived from the outside, from like longer standing Scientologists that understand what the OT levels are to some degree, not just like someone new who's like, ooh, OT levels, OT abilities, what's all that? Like they look at the upper OT levels, like OT7 and 6, you know, anyway, from 5 to 8, you know, they're like, if they were Christians, they'd be praying that they get to 8. Before they die, because, you know, they know that there can be serious health problems associated with going, you know, past the wall of fire.
So does that fuck with them psychologically? Like, okay, I made it to this grand
level. Well, you tell me, of course.
I failed because I have the level, but I can't produce any of the effects of it.
Yeah, you're going to be sitting there on the meter holding the cans looking for body thetans 24/7, man. That's what OT7 was for Kathy. You know, she would spend 8 hours on the cans.
Which Kathy?
Crazy. Kathy Steiner.
Okay.
She was the other mission holder, Tom and Kathy Steiner.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then she just finally said, fuck it. She's like, I guess I'm OT7. She never wanted to do OT8. He's like, Tom's OT8. She's like, Tom's OT8. It's all good. And there were a lot of OTs at the Ventura mission. A couple OTs at the we made an OT in Melrose. We made a – oh, my God. We made an OT at Melrose. Crazy.
Do they still
– Made two.
Do you think they still believe, or do you think they're like, oh man, this doesn't work, but it's got high esteem associated?
I wish I knew.
Take it.
I wish I knew. Marcus Coloma was a guy who's an actor, and he's a guy that me and my brother and Dominic got in, and he went all the way up and also got his L rundowns, all three L rundowns, which, by the way, are all about slavery, and it's enslaving people And it's a very bad rundown because like I said, whenever you're on staff and you're in the group think, Chris Shelton talks a lot about this, and he's got a lot of really cerebral information about, you know, it's very cerebral, but it's very informative. So his catchphrase on his website, entertaining, informative, or and something. But I agree with all three of them, well, even though I don't remember what the third one is. Yeah, critical thinking. And he explains a lot of this stuff, you know, in great, great detail. But the way I explain it is pretty simple. You know, you think of people as particles, and you control the group as a group of particles, like a swarm of bees, or, you know, anything that is like hive minded. And that's how it is on Scientology, in a Scientology org, or on a mission that is run like an org. And so, like, all the parts of that org or mission are one, and they work as one. So you never have a single solo person doing something unless it's an executive. And then executives have a whole nother level of executive briefing programming that they do, just like staff do staff status one, staff status two, and then their hatting, which is pre-selected and preordained by the executives. The executives actually, sometimes they actually like know who's going to be good at what, you know, like my brother Travis, he can be social, but he can also be shy. So like he got into the bookstore hat. They're like, yeah, you can sell books, because, you know, just even the way that he looks, they take that into consideration, I believe. And because I talk a lot, they're like, well, you're going to be the FSMIC, you know, and also had experience working with celebrities. So the Melrose Mission, having celebrities on their lines, like I was the only guy for the job, because I worked with Nashville celebrities and can work with Hollywood celebrities. You know, I mean, in Nashville, I've met a lot of Hollywood celebrities. So
let's get that acronym. What was it? What does that stand for?
What?
For the listeners, the FSMIC.
Field staff member in charge. And what that means is you go out, whether it's known that you're a Scientologist or not, so you can be incognito, or you can be like, hey, I'm a Scientologist, and you recruit people and you scout, kind of like being a scout for a record label, for at least my position was, because I was FSMIC for Celebrity Center's mission, and also an FSM for CCINT. And I was also an FSM for Advanced Org, which is where they do the OT levels. And I don't know if you remember a show called Grounded for Life, but I'm actually the guy that got Lindsay Bartleson on her OT levels at AO, which I feel horrible about, because I remember going to PAC base one day and she was sitting outside crying, like holding her briefcase, just crying her eyes out. And I know when I got her over there with the FSM slip that they got her for a lot of money.
Wow, so
it's shit like that made me compelled to say something or do something, you know. That's because these people were not people that I considered bad people, you know, because they were Scientologists. These were like some of these people, you know, I would have liked to have been friends with them. I was on staff, so that's not really a possibility, but, and that's another thing that really, harms your relationships and leaves you out on your ass when you leave, because you can't form a proper relationship with anybody. Right. So when you leave, you have nobody, and you don't even know how to have a relationship with yourself anymore.
You said a lot of you had a lot of interesting insights you've given us here through all this process. So we're kind of working backwards almost now. And I'm going to kind of use this as a segue to go back to the beginning because I think it's all connected in a way.
Sure.
On your website, you refer to yourself as an ex-psychopath, and you suggest that all Scientologists at one point or another were psychopaths, basically.
Yes, I did say that.
Traits. I'm going to go ahead and list the traits you put there. It was uncaring, emotionally shallow, irresponsible, insincere, overconfident, and carefree, and hopefully leaving Scientology. Everybody's pretty much moved on from that. Of course, we know there are some who probably still live in that mindset. You think that's kind of... I don't think people go into Scientology as psychopaths. They go in as people, as you mentioned earlier, that want to change the world and do some good or help themselves.
Yeah.
So when you describe, when you talk about how you got into Scientology, about the kind of help you were trying to get for yourself, it almost sounds like you're describing processes that are exactly what would cultivate, especially somebody who's going through something mentally, those psychopathic tendencies.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, no. The poison is not the cure.
Right.
Right?
Right. That's a great way to say.
But the I will say this, man. The they have these things called objective processes, and they're nothing more than stuff that people do. You know, it's just LRH had a way. He wanted to define everything and paint the entire damn world with his brush and technical dictionary. And so for me, before I really started on the purification rundown, I would be taken out by an auditor to walk down the street, and he would point at things and ask me, "Do you see that?" And I would look at it and I would say, "Yeah, I see that." And he would say, "Thank you." And I was like, "You're welcome."
What are you, an idiot? Right?
and then he said, "Oh, I'm doing an objective process, and this should help with your hallucinations. It'll help you focus your attention on single points, and hopefully, alleviate some of the anxiety and stuff." And I was like, "Well, I'll give it a shot." So we walked up and down this block for about 30 minutes. And he was pointing at shit, and I'm saying, "Yes, I see it. Yeah, thank you." And he's saying, "Thank you. Do you see that? Yes, thank 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 you." And then, so the end phenomenon of this is the pre-clear is showing what they call good indicators, which means like you've laughed or you've smiled or you have raised your tone level in any way. What I'm saying is that the looking at things and focusing on specific points with my eyes did seem to help the hallucinations.
Now, do you think that's because of a well-thought-out process to help those conditions, or do you think it's a bit of a coincidence?
I think it's more like distraction therapy. I learned later, whenever I got into some actual therapy, that that's what you do with people who are having schizoaffective disorders, you know? You do distraction therapy.
So there might have been a little bit of research done into that process, and then they just made it their own with the whole, "Do you see that? Do you see that?"
I personally believe that L. Ron Hubbard did do research on published things and then took what he wanted and put them in HCOPLs, which are HCO policy letters, and he put them in, and not just like psychological and psychiatric stuff. That's for sure he studied that, even though he hates them. But also government stuff, and unfortunately some really great religious texts like the Tao Te Ching and the Art of War and the Buddha Sutras and the Dhammapada and the Bible and all these great, you know, liturgical sources that have good principles to live by. He takes them and throws all that into his mind control crazy scheme. You know, that's the shame of it, because that's where people get stuck on it. That's how you get in, because there is a truth in there. There's lots of truths in there. And if you find the truth that you feel comfortable with, then you may be willing to abstain or abstend your be able to abstend your disbelief or suspend your disbelief of a particular concept or precept or whatever because of your particular love or affinity for a couple of the principles you do agree with.
Right. Right. Again, this goes right back to the whole, there's a greater cause, there's a greater good.
Yeah.
I can dismiss this.
Oh, yeah. People who are empathetic are just, you know, they're doomed, because if they really want to help, then there's a lot of bait there for them, you know?
We look for the good in things. So, and this happens in groupthink too, right? This happens. I talked to Chris Shelton about this a little bit. It happens in high school, and it happens in the workplace. It happens everywhere, where if somebody, if you find someone inspiring or someone you appreciate their work or you respect what they do, but then you start to see, and I guess it can work with celebrities, right? You start to see some questionable behavior from them. You will make every excuse for why it's not as bad as it looks.
Yeah.
It's a similar kind of thing, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, because you have, that you may not like all of it, but there are certain aspects of it that you feel are your own, that they are yours, they're part of you. And so you don't want to deny you, you know?
Right.
But that's the slippery slope with not just Scientology, but any cult, is the slow denying of self. And people who have lived in abusive relationships prior to Scientology or prior to being in a cult are even more susceptible to this kind of, unfortunate situation.
Yeah.
Because you're already preconditioned to believe that you should deny yourself and your own feelings. Like if you're an abused person, you're generally made to feel like you're not, your opinion isn't the right one, you know. Others know better.
Standards.
Yeah. You're not enough. You know. You need approval. You're codependent. Stuff like that. And that's what that is built on in Scientology. Codependence. Everyone's codependent.
All right. That's it for part one. Part two on Friday. Sorry, this one was the latest. It was aired last Friday, but had technical difficulties. He's got a lot more great things to say and some great insight. The conversation continues also with 10 questions. And at some point in the conversation, we realize we have a ton more to cover. So there'll probably be another part in the future. We'll come back and record. We have more things we want to talk about, and you'll hear about that next week. Again, if you want to contribute and do something, write your congressman. Try to get the IRS to take away tax exemption, vote for politicians that won't save point Scientology in our political system. Also, anything that doesn't involve giving stats to those two fools on Twitter. So next week, back with Marcus Sawyer Part 2. Thank you for listening. That about sums it up. Stay connected. See you next week.
If I speak for your followers, and I speak for your ex-followers, and I speak for the curious outsiders looking in, and you remain silent in the shadows and don't let your balls drop enough to come out and say something, then I say, who do you speak for, Mr. Miscavige?
Anything on earth that says, don't listen to your mum and dad, don't talk to your mum and dad, that's bad,
yep.
Wrong.
I remember sitting there wishing I could just scream out loud and beg for help. But I knew if I did that, I would never see Mark again.
This is the thing about real life. You can't experience the great thing without the bad thing.
I felt like it would probably be better off if we didn't exist. And, Tech came up with a plan on how to end it.
he talks about a 7-year-old child. Even if he's referring to actually an adult, so let's say we change that to an adult. Okay, the woman shudders because the man kisses her even passionately. The fact is that she shudders.
To do a big apology to me and give me my kids back.
I'm still shocked by the evil. Yes, even to this day, when I see a video of a former friend or family member, I'm like, this is pure evil at work.